fascinating. Gadgets, gizmos, and gear-based technologies.
Welcome to FGGBT. Now, this is the show that takes your favorite fictional science and technology, and we make it a reality. We are the Brain Trust. I am the analytical mastermind, Daniel J. Glenn. With me, the physics phenom, Dr. Michael Denon.
Dan, great to be here. Not only do we make their favorite fictional stuff a reality, you make my favorite TV shows a reality because I was way behind. I had not gotten around to watching this show, and now I've watched it, and I have you to thank, Dan.
Well, Denon, you're welcome. I like to make your to-do list a reality because we have to get through it somehow, and we'll do it together as friends. And there's one other person we have in our little friend circle, and that is our enigmatic engineer, Ben Siebser. Ben, how is your to-do list going up there on the Brain Station?
You know, Dan, I haven't shared this with you two, but, you know, I've been having trouble with one of my eyes. It's healing up, but in the meantime, you know, I think I may end up improving some of my other senses.
We can only hope. I imagine that must be a Three Stooges-related injury, or how did that happen?
If only it was that obvious, Dan.
That's okay.
Dan, I have a question for Ben. I'm sorry, Ben.
Sure,
don't
please.
You just dial up the controls on your other senses? Why do you need to have them improve naturally?
I still have the squishy brain, so you know, it's improving that interpretation of the sensory systems. That's what I'm working on.
Gotcha. Well, you have it for now. For now, yeah. You have a squishy brain. We're working on that.
Yeah,
this is, you know, this is going to be an episode that I think the theme is going to be our senses, improving them, using them. What are they? Are they even reliable? And this was inspired, as you mentioned, Denon, by the TV show Echo. And we're going to roll Daredevil into this because, this to me is my favorite sub-world of the Marvel Universe. You know, these are the characters. Kind of the world started originally on Netflix. It's Daredevil, it's Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, and Iron Fist, and Echo's in the Daredevil world. And I like these guys. I mean, they're grittier, they're dirtier. These are characters with B and C tier powers. So they're not the super. This isn't like ultimate power. This isn't like Thor or the Hulk, you know. So they've got to kind of rely on their humanity a little bit. To me, that makes them better superheroes and way more interesting.
I think so, Dan. I mean, there's always the discussion, right? Who's someone's favorite superhero? I don't have the depth of knowledge that you do, so I often go with Batman because he doesn't have any superpowers except a lot of money. We've talked about that a lot. I know he has superpowers, but of the superpowers, Spider-Man often almost gets into this category because his powers aren't as over the top as some superheroes. As I've been introduced to these in this group, they're definitely moving up my list rapidly, Dan.
And it just goes to show you, these are just such much more relatable characters. Like, we can all understand somebody who, you know, is impaired, is hard of hearing, is blind. But also, we can just appreciate people who, they're good at martial arts. You know, they went to the dojo, they practiced, and their power is just determination. And
right. And grit.
And grit. And not being lazy.
Yep. I mean, in this day and age, not being lazy is a superpower, you know. This is a strange,
certainly
strange
one I wish I had.
Yes. Yeah, it is crazy. I mean, you know, you can do that. And this is really what a lot of this is. It's a lot of martial arts and it's a lot of stick-to-itiveness, a lot of grit. And, you know, this particular episode, we're going to talk about two superheroes who are impaired in a way, right? I mean, they're traditionally impaired in that, you know, Daredevil is visually impaired. He can't see at all. He's blind, completely blind, to vision, I should say, to the visual spectrum, let's say. He can basically see the world anyway, but it's just a different way of seeing it. Echo is, I believe she's completely hearing impaired, no sound at all. And this is really interesting because I think it raises a question of how do we interpret the world? You know, I mean, I think, Denon, you introduced me to the fact that everything we see, hear, feel, taste, smell, it doesn't actually exist. It's just organs on our skull that are just interpreting molecules and chemicals and light spectra and then turning it into something, you know? It's kind of mind-blowing when you think that nothing that we see, hear, smell, taste, touch is real.
Well, it's so true, Dan. I mean, it might be real, let's be clear. But, you know,
hyperbolic, I apologize.
Well, as I've established, I am the only thing that's real. And it's so fun to talk with all of my imaginary friends every week.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've got this thing going on where the brain does so heavily interpret the world. And it's one of those deep questions of philosophy. It is actually a deep question of science. You know, how much of what's out there in our theories and our models are, quote, real versus our brain interpreting signals? I mean, that's ultimately what our brain does. As you said, we're sensory devices that interpret things. And then we impose that on all our other sensory devices. I mean, the number of things like the images that our telescopes measure. So many of our telescopes do not work in the visible, and yet turn their images into color images for all of us to look at, as if that was what it actually looked like, right?
Right.
And so we know that's not real, and yet we interact with it as if it is. And so it just fascinates me, that whole aspect of perception in life.
Yeah. Well, the thing that always bothers me is that touching isn't really touching, right? It's just our electrons repelling each other when you get too close. But, you know, that's the beauty of it, of being the electrical engineer that I am. Everything's just electromagnetism, whether it's the whether it's the photons coming into our eyes or everything else, which is electron repulsion.
And with enough force, you know, you could theoretically push yourself through anything, right? Just overcome that repulsion and get super weird, right? I think that's how you could really touch something.
I think you would end up getting consumed, because if you got that close, then the nuclear forces would attract and you'd like merge in, right? Right, Dan?
Create a fission reaction.
That feels right. It depends on how you're actually doing it. I think, we may call that a neutron star, Dan, when you push hard enough.
Okay. Well, and for those of you out here who want to do that, well, maybe we'll cover becoming your own neutron star in a future episode. But we're going to stick to senses for this one. But this is, you know, this raises an interesting question, because If you lose a sense, or let's say early on, right? Let's say you're born blind, or you're born with some kind of inner ear problem, you can't hear or hear properly to the normal range that we're used to as humans. Human beings have evolved to use all five senses in the ways that we use them to navigate the world. But if one of those is taken away, it's easy for human beings to adapt, right? I mean, what seems, you know, to a sighted person like myself, to lose that early on, how a blind person would navigate the world now would be alien to me, but is perfectly functional and in some ways superior. The hearing, the touch would be superior to anything that I would pick up. But it is interesting just how human beings have evolved one way, but we're so adaptable that whatever is alien, you know, to me would not be to them.
You know, Dan, and I think that goes to the great power of the brain. I think we often underestimate, you know, I love what you said, adaptability of humans, that's super high. And you mentioned it earlier, the brain taking in all the senses, right? The brain is designed to create a model of reality that you can navigate. And it's almost like our senses are redundant systems. You might think we were designed really well. I hate to bring up that, you know, that sort of dangerous route, but evolution does a really good job of making things that can work and have fail safes. Hence the reason we like to steal so much of our technology from biology.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a very good point.
Yeah. And, you know, we look at our relatives, because our closest animal relatives, and there's a lot of the spectrum of sense preference, I guess we would call it, sense priority, is pretty skewed. Like, a lot of monkeys have better hearing than we do. A lot, or if we look a little further away, like, birds have much better sight and hearing than we do. So there's such an interesting spectrum that we both evolve and adapt in our niches to prioritize the senses that make the most sense for where we're living.
Yeah, it is strange because if you look at, I mean, like you said, sense priority is an interesting way to put it because all animals kind of use their senses in different ways. You know, I mean, snakes can sense heat, you know, which is crazy. Yeah. Cave animals are completely blind. There's no need to take any sort of light in because they're, that doesn't exist. There's no reason to use that. Sharks can sense blood, one part per million of blood in the water. That's crazy. I mean, you look at dogs, right? Like, you know, my dog kid, well, not now, but, you know, in her prime, she could hear better than I could. She could smell better. And that gives her a totally different view of the world. When she puts her head on the ground, I have no idea the world of smells that she's getting. She knows what other dogs have come by. You know, that's her world, right? And smells. And it's just so interesting how every animal on the planet is just geared differently. So, which means that all those possibilities are possible. So if we wanted to adapt our hearing a little bit better, we could hear the world and get a quasi-visual view and enough that we could navigate it, like you said, Den. And that's really how we navigate reality.
No, it's so true. And, you know, I love, there's a number of authors I've known who have attempted to describe dogs seeing the world through sense of smell. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And it's always fascinating the ways they try and do that. They often use colors and stuff for the smells. I do have to throw out there, you know, for our big fans who are D&D players, there's also that, you know, sort of developing those extra senses like dark vision because you just don't want to track torches.
Mm-hmm. It goes back to that lazy issue.
It goes back to that lazy issue, right? The superpower of you know, non-laziness could come into play here again.
Yeah, well, or we can relate it to everyone's favorite Marvel dog, Pizza Dog Lucky, who's, you know, we see there's a great comic that is from his perspective. And, you know, he doesn't understand words, but you see his smells and his sights as he does his own crime fighting. and it shows that, you know, a dog with its different priorities of senses can do just what a human does, but in a different way.
And it totally, and it, the approaches are what's so interesting, you know, a smell first approach is not something that I think would work for humans because, you know, most of us can't smell that much. I mean, really, you can't, when you smell things that are really bad, you're like, oh my God, my nose is killing me. But in the grand scheme of the world, we don't really smell much, which is a whole world out there we're not experiencing. But this is crazy. So just transitioning into Daredevil really quickly, because I think this is exactly what we're talking about. You know, traditionally, Daredevil, Matt Murdock, is blind. He was he became blind later in life. So he had his brain had been attuned to what visual stimulation was like, so that when he uses the other senses, he can kind of build a visual world that he can navigate. But I think it's interesting because when you look at Daredevil and you see the things that he does to compensate for that, you know, hearing much better, touch, smell, all that, you start to realize just how reliant human beings are on vision and how easy it is to fool us. You know, I mean, there's magic tricks are completely, it's all visual, right? You take a card here and you make it disappear, you know, over here, and you're tricking someone's senses. I don't even want to go into Instagram pictures, how those can fool us. But I do, I have to say, I was going to pitch a magic show where you do magic tricks to dogs and see if they can figure out where everything is, because they're seeing things in a totally different world. I think it would be fun. But anyway, it's crazy how reliant we are in this sense.
Yeah. Well, you know, Dan, and it goes to the connection also between sight and the brain. I'm one of those weird people. I loved as a kid when I discovered that you could draw the wireframe of a cube and make it either pointed at you or away from you. Mm-hmm. I loved training my brain to make that switch on command. Like I could make myself see it the way I wanted. And I just love all optical illusions like that. And I was one of the people who got all in. I actually had those 3D posters in my house as art. I don't know how many of our viewers know these, where you stare at them and suddenly something pops out in 3D, right? Like dolphins or whatever. And being really good at doing that, because it felt to me like that psychic control of my brain over reality. But it was all through that sense of sight and the interaction between your brain and your other senses.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to take it back to the magic tricks for dogs, though, Dan, have you not seen the Instagrams of people like hiding behind a blanket and then running through a door and dropping the blanket and the dog freaks out? I mean,
no, I haven't. I think this would be really interesting, and not in a cruel way. I love animals, but I feel like they can sniff out, no pun intended, all the things you're doing because they see it differently. But also, yeah, their vision's not great, so you can trick them a little bit.
Yeah, dogs are colorblind compared to us, so.
Yeah.
So, Dan, I have to tell you. No, I mean, I know we're on magic and sense of sight. So my youngest brother, and I say youngest, and he's in his late 40s now, Down syndrome, great kid. You know, he works at, I won't name the hotel because I don't want to advertise him as a dishwasher. Very, very high-functioning life. But as a child, you know, those magicians would show up at our table, right, to do magic tricks and try and get money in balloons. And the best moment was the magician shows up and said, you know, would you like me to do a trick where I make a coin disappear? My brother goes, sure, and closes his eyes. And he does that because when he did magic for us, he made us close our eyes so he could make something disappear. So he thought he'd help out the magician and close his eyes ahead of time.
Yeah, but there's a wisdom in that, right? Like, because that's how, you know, when you think about it, that thing, so much happens when you can't see because there's so much that is removed from the world, which makes some of these things so interesting. So that's great. So this is, Ben, you actually turned me on to a magician named Richard Turner, who is, I mean, easily considered the best. They call him card mechanics, but he can manipulate a deck of cards better than maybe anyone in history. He's definitely learned from the best. He's one of the greatest card. Tricks is a hard work, so it's not magic in that sense. Yeah. But he's able to stack a deck and draw any card you want, deal from the bottom, deal from the second card, all that kind of three card Monty stuff, right? And it's interesting because he can't see. He's legally blind. His vision has gotten slowly worse over the years, and it's just amazing because how do you know you've done the trick correctly? That's always what was. Yeah. Interesting to me, like how do you can shuffle, right? Like you can practice shuffling and know whether that's smooth, but how do you know you pulled the right card? That's unbelievable to me. Mind blowing.
Yeah, it's wild to me that he can like deal seconds without seeing if he's disturbing the top card in a way that makes it obvious. Like how he did that, I don't know. I mean, but I guess in some ways he can probably feel it, right? He can feel the actual top card and make sure it's not doing what it needs. Make sure it's not doing what would give it away. And he probably can sense that. That tactile sense is probably more in tune for him than it is for other people. So he is able to better control the cards than someone who is looking at it would, because they're getting distracted by what they're seeing.
And I think, Ben, totally in that case, so much of magic is not looking at what you're doing so other people don't look. Like, we have a tendency to look where somebody else's looks. And he's got this natural advantage that he can't see anyway, so why look at it, right? So he really, really is doing it all the way you're supposed to do it. And, yeah, Dan, I went back and rewatched him last night because we had talked about him. And it is just – it is so fun to watch and watch him do what he does.
Yeah,
but you're doing something for a visual audience. The whole point is you want to see this trick happen, and he doesn't ever really know whether whether it happened or not, which is so cool. And the other thing that's crazy about him is he earned a black belt in karate, and this is exactly like there. Oh, one thing before I mentioned the black belt, it's interesting that you mentioned the tactile sense, Ben, because we see Daredevil. You know, without sight, he kind of relies on hearing. You know, I think there's a famous scene in that fantastic Jennifer Garner, Ben Affleck version of Daredevil where it starts to rain and the sound bouncing off from the raindrops creates like a complete image of his surroundings, right? So he's very reliant on his hearing. But with Richard Turner, it's all touch. It's all tactile. Yeah. I think he's literally shuffled cards in his right hand since he was 10 years old. I mean, he does it all the time. It's like his security blanket. He's always shuffling and moving cards. It's very tactile. And to your point, Denon, that is what he uses to kind of figure out the world. And he learned karate, but he did it the tough way. He had to actually learn or earn his black belt the tough way. He had to learn karate and then to earn his black belt, go 10 3-minute rounds with a new opponent in every round while being visually impaired. That feels like Daredevil to me. I don't know. I mean, that's pretty. I mean, the thought of that is just crazy.
who would have thought one of the greatest card mechanics in the world is also the real Daredevil?
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah, what a cover. I mean, talk about being a superhero, right? I mean, it's crazy. But, you know, I mean, I've done martial arts, and I've gotten my butt kicked, and I can see perfectly well. So I don't know what that means. But Dedan, I think you told me a story once how you had your eyes closed and you could feel people coming up on you, right? Like you kind of related to that a different sense to kind of feel the world around you.
No, I did, and I want to be clear. It was very rarely my eyes closed in people. It's in sports, Dan, and you should relate to this, right? Okay. That instinct that you're about to get hit in the back of the head with something and you duck not knowing why, right? And I suspect, I suspect really for me it was a combination, I guess, of maybe sense of touch, like feeling the air or whatever ahead of time, maybe a little bit of sound that I didn't recognize, maybe I heard it coming, and maybe just dumb luck.
But I think, you know, that might be because
that is my superpower, dumb luck. I know.
Well, I've had a basketball whiz at me a couple times, and I've caught one in the face. I actually broke my finger. Someone threw a hot pass at me. I think he was trying to hurt me, but I broke my finger playing a pickup game with a bunch of people I didn't know. So I don't know that I have. I wish I could relate, Denon. I wish I could get out of the way of balls flying at me. One other quick thing here, which is interesting, is there's a wrestler. His real name is Steven Scott, but he's called Crazy Steve. And I didn't know this until recently, but he's also legally blind. So not only do you have people, you know, Richard Turner, who's fighting people, but this is choreographed stuff. There's ropes jumping through them. There's obstacles that you're constantly, you know, being involved with. Navigating that kind of world is also extraordinarily impressive. And to do this at such a high level, you know, that's what I it's possible. What I'm saying is, if you're out there, you're visually impaired, your road to being a superhero is wide open for you.
That kind of makes me wonder which is easier or harder. I guess they're probably just different, but like the grappling of wrestling, I would imagine in some ways is more suited to the blind because it's that tactile sense where you're almost always in contact with your opponent versus the karate where you have to like know if the kick is coming or not.
Right. Yeah. Because even, you know, what's interesting about like uppercuts and someone, let's say someone is experienced in boxing, they're really only focused on elbows up. You know, you take your fist and you cover your head with both of them. Your entire lower half is exposed because that's pugilism is a sport. It's a, you know, it's only waist up. But with karate, any kind of martial arts, when kicks are involved, stuff's coming from the bottom. Uppercuts are coming from the bottom up. And, you know, we can't even if you're fully sighted, you can't see everything. We're not birds. You can't see around your head. You can't see up and down. So things coming out of nowhere, that's a problem for anyone.
You know, Dan, the only thing I would say to that, though, is those of us with awesome peripheral vision, and I'm not saying that's me. I'm just saying those of us who have awesome peripheral vision do have an advantage, get a little bit of the up-down side-to-side sight, and we're seeing more. So, you know, I think that's our only hope for those of us with vision is to really work on the peripheral vision.
Oh, it's absolutely true. Those are your elite point guards and quarterbacks and stuff like that. That is true. Well, this is interesting because, you know, if you don't have a particular sense, right, you know, we've got gigantic sections of our brain dedicated to each one of our senses. But let's say you can't see. You know, your entire vision part of your brain is not going to be used for that, but it can be repurposed. You know, you are dedicating the bandwidth that we normally interpret sight, sound, you know, sight and hearing and all that. Now, one of those is gone and there's more bandwidth of your brain to really process the other parts of the world. And this is interesting. So, you know, I think I've mentioned this gentleman before, but his name's Daniel Kish. And he's one of these human beings that is just, I mean, beyond remarkable. But he taught himself, he's blind. So when he was 1 year old, he had an aggressive form of eye cancer. They removed his eyes. So he really hasn't ever been able to see. And he taught himself how to echolocate. And I was reading the article, I put it up on the website. He's so good at this that an interviewer coming to speak with him for an article they were writing, Daniel was able to tell him that his car was parked too far away from the curb. I don't even, and he was like 10 feet away, 10, 15 feet away. I don't even know how that's possible. But it is, right? It is. And that's what's amazing about physics, Denon. I mean, he's basically utilizing physics. You know, he's bouncing sound off stuff and he's hearing it. It's crazy.
Well, and I think there's two sides to this physics, Dan, that are important for people to understand that are impressive. One is, you know, we're not designed to make necessarily loud enough sounds that have the staying power to travel, bounce off something, and come back to us, right? The physics of generating the sound is something you have to work on. And frequency matters. This is why he's probably making clicks and stuff, right? The frequency of your sound can impact how far it goes, how good it is at reflecting off stuff. The higher the frequency, the smaller objects you can see, the better resolution you have. That's just a physics principle. And then the other thing is just your ears, right? They have to be designed to hear the stuff coming back and detect the right levels and block out all the other noise around us. And I said two things. It's actually three. And of course, your brain then interpreting it correctly. Because we all know two and three, that's just within the error bars, Dan.
So another thing that's interesting here, Denon, is, you know, you mentioned the sound waves. So the thing I forgot to really, I don't know if I hit this point home, but human beings, we're really, all of our senses are tuned into the things we need, right? We see visual, the visual light, because that's kind of all we need. Our ears, the dynamic range, you know, the lowest we can hear to the highest we can hear, is really geared to human voice and a little bit above and beyond, like above and below that, you know? And you're right. So what staccato clicks is, that's an Italian term. I was in band for a few years. So it's these sharp clicking sounds. They move mostly in one direction, and they can bounce off of things versus a voice, which kind of spreads out. It's more diffused. So these clicks are perfectly suited for this. And it's interesting. So Daniel Kish is kind of the poster child for this technique in human beings. But there's actually another person. This is crazy. A gentleman named Ben Underwood, and I was watching this documentary about him. And in the documentary, it says that he's the only person in the world who can do this, but he clearly came 20 years after Daniel Kish. Nonetheless, he must have spontaneously done this as well, right? And I think that that requires, in a lot of ways, that requires such a superior intellect because your brain has to work in a different way, right? I mean, there's only a couple people who have come up with this. It's clearly possible. But I was watching this great video of this very complex situation where there's like ramps going up to these tables and this two board set where like you could just kind of walk across. You have to kind of be very precarious about it. And at the end of this obstacle course is a gigantic thing of food, all right? And so all of these corgis are led into the room. And immediately one corgi figures it out in 2 seconds. Meanwhile, all the other corgis are jumping and trying to get there, right? And there's another corgi who like comes a little bit later. So you have like your genius corgi. Then you got like your pretty smart corgi. And then you kind of got everyone else. And I feel like that's how these two are, is it's like they're kind of operating at a level that's different because they're able to figure something out that I don't think most humans would even consider trying out.
And I've even seen people who use like the clickers, like you use for animal training to do echolocation as well. But to bring up the animals, that's so interesting because, like, as you mentioned, you know, people are tuned to what people have to exist as. We generally speaking exist on a 2D plane and need to hear human voices and, you know, lions jumping out of the brush. Right. That's what we're evolved for.
Those two things. Yeah, that's right. Those and two tigers. Things. I would say tigers maybe. Yeah, sometimes.
Maybe tigers as well. I'm thinking of probably jaguars. Think of what's in Africa. But, and a bull elephant charging us.
Those four things and people.
Those four things. That's only problem. But if you look at other areas of the animal kingdom, like say owls, owls have their ears pointed in different directions, so they also hear in 3D. So they don't have to move their heads up and down to hear if things are above or below them. Humans suck at that. We can't tell if sounds are above or below us. And to go back to the magic tricks, that's one way to trick people is to play sounds below you and you can make it sound like it's above you.
Yeah. Well, there's interesting microphones, actually. They're 3D microphones. So you can record something in 3D. And when you hear it, It's wild. It sounds, I mean, it's full spectrum around. You can feel something like walk around you and above you. It's crazy the things you can do with sound. But because I think we, it's interesting because I think we see and hear at a, it's not particularly good. Our hearing is not very good in comparison to other animals. Our sight is very, very poor. But yet we rely on both of those extraordinarily well. Like sight seems to be primary for humans. Sound is secondary, and everything else, smell and taste and touch, they all kind of augment that. They kind of make those more real, add the details, if you will, right? But it is funny how poor we really are at those two things that we rely on so much.
Well, we're poor compared to like birds, sight-wise, but our eyes are pretty good in the mammal spectrum. Okay. You know, our eyes are a lot better than dog eyes, for example.
Sure.
So, we're not total amateurs here.
That's good. All right. Yeah, let's give ourselves some credit here, right? But there's one other thing I want to talk about. So, we may have talked about this before, but synesthesia is this crazy neurological condition where you kind of have a crossing of the senses. You know, some people claim to be able to see music. You know, or things like that. Where basically what's happening is in the brain of someone with this one stimuli, you know, like hearing music using your auditory senses, goes on two pathways. So it stimulates both your auditory center of your brain, but also your visual center of the brain. So in a lot of ways, it's been postulated, and there's some research that's being worked on, that you can actually, this is a more complete auditory sense. You're actually, it's like the extrasensory kind of stuff, right? Like it's not ESP in that you're seeing things that aren't there, but it's not only can I hear, but I can see what I hear. That I would love to be able to experience that. I don't know how to replicate that, but that feels like a full sensory experience.
Well, you know, Dan, it's also kind of, it goes back to where we opened, where your senses are almost more your brain than the detection mechanisms, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. What we see is what the visual part of your brain creates out of electrical signals. Your brain doesn't actually see anything. Your brain gets a set of electrical signals. And your ear and eyes both just make electrical signals, right? The original source is different, but the chemistry at the other side is the same.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
So sending sound into the visual brain, of course it will create a visual experience, because that's what that part of the brain does. Now, how that relates to a visual experience created by what your eyes are bringing in is also interesting, because it's not going to be a one-to-one match.
Right.
Right. Yeah. It's going to be some sort of different thing. But it is interesting to think about taking the same input and making two different maps out of it, and then using those two maps to navigate. That's basically what you're doing, which is very cool.
It makes me wonder if a person with like perfect pitch just sees the notes on the on the clefs and can that's the A. Look, it's right there.
I knew a guy with perfect pitch. I went to school with someone who is in the music school, and he had perfect pitch. It's an interesting that I wonder. That's an interesting theory. I don't know how that works, but I do know one thing that I thought was interesting is that, you know, during people who contracted COVID, a lot of people lost their sense of taste. Their sense of smell, which affected their sense of taste. And some people had to relearn it. You know, it was almost like the wiring got fried. You know, I know people who had this happen to them. And it is strange because it's like the reverse of synesthesia, right? Like it's smells like you, let's say you originally smelled garlic and it smelled like garlic, what you were trained that garlic smelled like, but now it smells like burning oil, let's say. And so it's a very different thing, because then that affects how you taste food and what you like to eat and what you don't like to eat. And it's a, you know, our brains in this category, what I'm just trying to hit home is that it can get pretty weird up there in our old noggin. You know, things can get kind of mixed around. And so our senses are difficult to trust in.
Oh, definitely. And it's so interesting, like you said, that they can get crossed and mixed up. You can have them wired to different places, or as your example gave, just like altered in this weird way that this, what used to be the signal for garlic is now the signal for, I don't know why you picked burnt oil. I assume this is a real example, Dan.
No, not at all. I couldn't, but it's a totally random example. I don't know anyone who's done that at all.
Well, but it also just goes to show the subjectivity of taste and smell. Mm-hmm. Because there are some things I like or I don't like that I'm sure you like, Dan. Like, I don't know if you like raw onions, but I hate raw onions.
I do like
and
raw
onions. And so, you know, I bet we were getting the same, roughly the same olfactory electrical signal to our brains.
Yes.
But for some reason, in my brain, I go, ew, gross, mm-hmm. and you don't.
There's some people eat them like apples, which is beyond
me. That's wild.
That should be criminal. I don't know what, that shouldn't be allowed. That's really something. Well, yeah, so it's interesting. So let's move on to Echo. You know, Maya Lopez. She's called Echo in the comic books. I don't know if that, the series is called Echo, but they don't really give her that name, but that's who we're talking about, Maya Lopez. And this is the opposite. So she is completely, completely deaf, no hearing at all. And in some ways, she has to double down on vision. You know, and there are advantages, I think, that she shows. There are advantages and disadvantages to this approach. You know, I think because we often are so distracted by sounds. And as you mentioned, Ben, in your example with tigers jumping out of the bush, you know, tigers are stealthy for a reason, because they don't want you to hear them. And if you can't hear, they can be super stealthy, you know, but you, if you are not distracted by the thought of maybe a tiger coming through the brush, you can be hyper focused. And that, I think, really becomes, you know, the weapon of choice for Maya, is that she is really focused and able to tune out a lot of the things that might pull an average person's attention.
And Dan, I love your example of the tiger, because I'll go to my cats. There are moments where I turn around and my cat is there, and I really don't know how the cat got there. And it was somewhere else a moment ago. Yep. And there is literally like no sound. Like it is incredible. I will tell you, the funny thing is, my cats are rather large. The one time you really hear them is if you're down like in the first floor and they're running upstairs right above you. You don't hear the pause, but you hear the weight. There's the thump, thump, thump.
Yeah. How big
on the floor.
Are these? How big are they? Like bobcat size? Or what are we looking at here?
They're like, you know, 15 pounds-ish. You know, that range.
Sure.
They're like small dogs, big cats. Yeah. But just the silence of them. And it is a difference. Our dog clicked. Our dog did not know what to do with those nails, and we have wooden floors. The dog never snuck up on me.
No.
But the cats... The cats all the time. But you're right. If I was more sort of visually aware of my surroundings, maybe my sense of touch or smell. I mean, I have a feeling my cats have an odor to them that I'm not detecting, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Because they're constantly sniffing, and they notice each other, right? Because they're using these other senses. Mm-hmm. So it's really, I think, you know, Maya's intense extra awareness is definitely a superpower here.
That makes me think about dogs more, because, you know, dogs obviously are hunters in the wild, but like, I don't think I've ever been snuck up on by a domestic dog. I guess they're just so happy and loud. They don't have to worry about it.
I had a dog when one of my dogs was a puppy. When I'd watch TV and it would be dark in the room, she used to stare at me out of the corner of my eye and then would slowly creep up on me and then leap on me. So she tried. I don't know if she was raised by cats. But as she got bigger, she kind of lost that ability. But she tried. So I've been snuck up on by a dog. So I don't know what that says about me. But
Dan, you've also been hit in the face by baseballs or basketballs. So.
And I think that tells us something. You know, I think that definitely tells us something. Well, and it's not only the focus, but... You know, if you're able to not be distracted by what someone is, you know, when people lie to you, right, you hear one thing and that makes your brain do something to maybe believe them. But some people can pick up on tells. You know, this is poker players are great at this. What are they actually doing? When someone's bluffing, they're telling you that, oh, I've got a pair of aces, but maybe they got a 2 of 7 offsuit, right? If you're hyper-focused and you're not listening to what someone is saying, but you're listening to what they're doing, that is really key here. And I think Maya really is good at dialing in on those, the little things that she notices, because she's also a fighter, right? And she's seeing when there's a whole scene where she's seeing where someone's hand is twitching right before they punch, or does their leg go, like, do they stiffen up? Those little things, seeing your heartbeat pulse in your neck, these are things that are very crucial that I don't think when we as humans kind of take in the broad spectrum visual stimuli. But looking at those little details, guys, that's key here.
Well, and I think there's two things, Dan. It's looking at the details while also having the broad field of vision, right? I think it's both sides of vision. I mean, my daughter makes fun of me playing video games that I have no, like, screen awareness, right? Like, because the video games I played, you didn't have to notice that the thingy over there might have the thing and the treasure and blah, 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 right?
Right.
Like, but, you know, she needs to be able to see the whole screen and pick out details from the whole screen. And I think it's those two extremes that Maya can do. She's seen everything in front of her, taking it all in, and noticing the little tells and twitches. It's a skill I had to develop as a parent of a dance child. I had to reach the point where I could watch my child dance, but watch the entire dance to get that full experience. And that took years of work on my side because my sight is not at the level of Maya.
No, that's very true. And most people don't like looking at other kids either. So I imagine that.
Right,
That's a tough transition. Well, you know, and what's really cool about this is we see that almost everyone in Maya's town can speak sign language. And it made me realize just how universal sign language could be. Why this is not the world's language, I have no idea, because it's all concepts, right? There's no grammar, really. There's not worrying about spelling things correctly. It's, you know, if you want to eat, you take your hand and you put it towards your mouth, right? I mean, it's not always that simple, but it's concepts. It's just like a lot of, you know, Asian languages, the characters represent full concepts and ideas. And this is in some ways also an extraordinarily efficient way to communicate. And I would say, if for anyone who's ever been stuck in a foreign country, not been able to speak the language, an incredibly primal way to speak, you know, we've all been in a situation where we point to ourselves when we're trying to talk to, well, I am this person. You are this person, point at them. So this feels very universal, guys. And I want to, you know, put a petition out there to make this the world's language.
Well, Dan, I totally get where you're coming from. This is clearly the episode where I highlight my brother. You know, when he was young, being Down syndrome, speaking came slower, right? Everything was slower. But he definitely learned some sign language early on much faster. And he was able to, you know, say when he was hungry, when he wanted to eat, drink. So I've forgotten like the six signs I learned when he was young because I am not good at any language, spoken or signed. But
English. Don't sell yourself short. You're okay.
I'm okay in English, Dan.
Yeah, you're okay.
I've worked, you know, it's been 50 plus years I've been working at it. It took that long to get to this level.
Right. Yeah.
But I will tell you, I totally related to your comment of being in a foreign language, in a foreign country. I was also in a foreign language once, but that's a different story.
Yeah.
But I remember being on the train from Versailles back to Paris, and we were sitting there. It was a really hot day. And my friend and I had an entire conversation with this very nice couple across from us. Totally in gestures and signs because none of us spoke the same language. I assume we all thought we were saying the same things, but it was a very fun conversation.
Yeah, it's all interpreted as you want to see it. I mean, this reminds me of when my nephew was a baby. You know, babies can learn, as you talked about with your brother, Ben, you know, babies are able to learn signs long before they're able to speak, just because it's a more difficult, you know, muscle control to talk. And my nephew could, you know, ask for more food. He could, you know, say when he had to go to the bathroom, all these amazing things long before he spoke. We took him to the Long Beach Aquarium and he was making the fish sign the entire time. Like, look at the fish, look at the fish.
Yeah.
It was very cute, but it was great because, you know, you could communicate with him long before he could speak.
And I think this is probably how early humans communicated with each other or if they encountered other tribes, right? I mean, if you don't speak the language, there's something universal. So it's not, you know, I mean, look, I've got some Italian friends and, you know, sign language is in addition to spoken language. You know, it's augmenting the language. You know, I think we've all seen that. Ben, I think you were telling me about transcribing sign language. Isn't that like that's a whole world in and of itself.
Yeah, well, we see Kingpin give Maya this, I guess, computer contact lens or whatever.
Yeah.
So she can see him doing signs in this, like, ghost form. I don't think we have any apps that do that exactly. But there's plenty of apps that can take speech and turn it into, like, an avatar, like a kind of cartoonish avatar doing signs. So we very easily with text or speech to text systems combined with that system, you can absolutely do this great interpretation where people can speak and it goes directly to signs and vice versa. And, you know, that it's a great way to increase that ability of communication. You know, it was very lovely that everyone in Maya's town learned sign language basically to speak with her. Mm-hmm. But with computer technology today, we're in a world where you have technology that can do that translation interpretation for you.
Right.
And you don't, I mean, it's great if you do learn the sign language because it probably gives you a better understanding of how Maya is thinking and communicating. But at the same time, you don't need to do that, and you can communicate with anybody.
Yeah, I think that that's really important, and it speaks to the universality of it, right? I mean, I think this is something anyone can learn because it's just concepts. You know, we've all been hungry. We've all wanted to go to a different place than where we were. We all know who we are and who other people are. So it's very universal. But one of the other things that I think is kind of interesting about this show is we learn later on. So I would say that Maya, you know, we talked about earlier Maya being a low power superhero, right? But we learn it in this series that she does have a power, you know, a power that's been passed on to her, and that's the ability to heal others. But this is what's interesting, is I've never seen this particular, normally when you think of healing, you think of like Wolverine style, you get your arm cut in a fight and it heals up, or, you know, you are, it's impossible to kill you. Deadpool, I think, is similar to Wolverine, where no matter how much damage they take, they can heal up over time. But her powers are to heal others. And she does this extraordinarily interesting thing where Kingpin, who is kind of like her surrogate father, he's a bad guy, right? I mean, like all of us, I'm sure he's a troubled person who means to do well, but ends up doing bad. He ends up being, you know, the kingpin of crime. So he's not a good guy. But she touches his head and is able to heal his childhood trauma. So it's not healing his actual body, but she heals his mind. And this in some ways is extraordinarily powerful because his entire identity and drive is attached to the trauma he had as a child. And if you heal that instantaneously, like how would that completely change the fundamental fabric of who the Kingpin is?
Well, you know, Dan, it was interesting because, you know, you mentioned this and I think about our Wish episode. And I distinguish between two things, I think, here, for me anyway. One is removing completely a trauma and pain versus healing a trauma and pain.
Okay.
They're both going to change you, but I think in different ways, right? You know, if you totally remove something and it's not a part of you anymore, I really, you know, it's a totally radical, perhaps, change of your personality and everything is different. But what I feel happened here is the memory of the experience is still there. The trauma was still experienced, but you've been able to deal with it in a way you haven't before. That's what the healing really is, right? Is to minimize it in this moment in time, but not take it away, right? And I feel like that is still dramatic, and your future will now be different and new, but it's dramatic in a smoother way.
Okay.
A more continuous way, right? Like you still have that trauma and the strength maybe you draw from it to draw on, but now maybe you have a more positive way to draw on it and to channel it. So I think there's a really cool difference between removing something and healing something.
It's like cutting it out versus editing it. Like a cut a cut from a Word document versus just editing and changing the word.
And smoothing it over, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if we think about it, is specifically in Kingpin. What Kingpin learned as a child was that violence was the solution to problems, right? His dad was abusing his mom and he beat his dad in return to stop his mother's abuse. And so he has taken that forward in that any slight is met with violence. And if Maya teaches him or heals the trauma of violence isn't the solution, you now end up with a kingpin who is going to use negotiation, politic, and other ways to fix the problems he sees rather than just beating people.
But the beating people worked for him, though. He's the kingpin of crime. So, I mean, it kind of worked. I mean, we can't deny that his approach was a very successful one.
Well, it worked, but it created a lot more trauma, too.
Sure. more beatings, more problems, for sure. So I think, but I would argue, that Ben, I would argue that beating people might be the, if you want to raise to the highest levels of the gang enterprise, the gang world, I think that's what you got to do. You got to meet people with violence. But I could be wrong. But if I am, here's a great place to do it. Errors, additions, and omissions section. Things we wanted to talk about, but we didn't quite get to. Denon, is there anything about... hearing, seeing, senses, your brother, or using violence to get what you want that you wanted to discuss?
Well, I just want to point out what a genius I am, Dan, because this is errors, additions, and subtractions, right? And as a genius, I analyzed, you know, the movies and came up and realized the difference between disaster movies and superhero movies. Mm-hmm. And there is a scene in this movie where Maya totally takes out all the bad guys. They're knocked unconscious. Best case scenario, worst case scenario, half of them are dead. Or I don't know, maybe that's the best case and the unconscious is the worst case.
Right. Perspective.
Immediately after that, because her cousin's held hostage, she is trapped. And all the bad guys are, as far as I can tell, I didn't do a careful count. All the bad guys are standing around looking at her. This is clearly a Marvel adventure movie because death was not real. whereas if this had been a disaster movie, death would be real. And all those extraneous characters would stay dead as if a shark ate them. So this is clearly a Marvel movie, not a disaster movie. And I continue to use my newfound knowledge for good.
Well, be careful. You're infringing on my gimmick. I am the master of film and television, but you can certainly be a novice of film and television. You're a Padawan.
Perfect.
A Padawan of film and television. What about you, Ben? Anything about this movie you wanted to talk about?
Well, you know, seeing how Maya helped the Kingpin by healing his trauma, I just got to wonder, is she suited, you know, should she start like a psychology practice where she just, you know, heals your brain and, you know, one session, all your trauma is healed. You know, she's going to put all the psychologists out of business or something, but... I think she's got something there.
I'm with you, Ben. I think she should heal her own trauma. I don't know if it's possible. And I think maybe she would go into that because, like Kingpin, she's using violence to get, you know, answers to her problems, you know, I think she wants to go down a different path for sure. Well, you guys, this is the errors, additions, and omission. And rarely do I add errors here. But for those of you who watch the YouTube version, you will know that when I, and yes, unfortunately, it is mostly I, when I make a mistake, I will correct it immediately on screen. But here, if you're listening to the audio version, I don't get to do that as immediately. So I've got to wait a couple of episodes. So there's a couple things I totally screwed up on, guys, that I gotta come clean on. First of all, this one blew my mind. In one of the recent episodes, I talked about how George Reeves and Christopher Reeves was George Reeves' son. I couldn't have been more wrong. George Reeve singular and Christopher Reeves plural are completely unrelated. They just happen to have very similar names and both played Superman. News to me. I had no idea.
Wow.
I genuinely thought that was the family business. So I apologize for that. You do, in fact, have 32 teeth in your head. You have three sets of molars on each sides and up and down. I don't know what you would call that. Ornithogonally, you have three molars in your head. And the last set are called your wisdom teeth. And we never got to how the Megalodon may very well be convergent evolution, having lived down there, and may not actually be a Megalodon. I completely forgot to make that point. Ben, I think you called me on this. We teased it early. We missed it late, but it's very possible the Megalodon in the movie Meg may have completely evolved on their own. And just in this movie, I loved weaponizing Skee-Ball and House of the Dead, which is some of my favorite arcade games, and that pellet gun out of Skates. But that's not it. If there's anything, that's a lot. That's a mouthful. But if there's anything else that I missed, please let us know about it. You can get in touch with the show. That's probably the best way to do it. We are on X, formerly Twitter, at FGGBTpod, Facebook, at FGGBT, website, FGGBT.com. And if you want to send us an email, it's questions at FGGBT.com. But you can get in touch with us individually. Denon, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on most major social media by flipping my name, at Denon Michael. I've added a special Instagram account, at Physics of X, with a lot of cool short videos on things that are either exploding or are foam. If you want the longer YouTube video versions, this is, you know, you just go to my YouTube channel, which is old enough that it is actually Michael Denon, and you can find the Physics of X there. If you want me to contact me on Facebook, that is at Prof Denon Michael. You got to stick a prof and flip my name. Not quite as complicated as you, Dan, but I'm getting close.
You're getting very close, very close. But I still hold the number one spot. I am the champion of complicated social media handles. But there is one man, and that is our enigmatic engineer, who's pretty consistent. Ben, what are you on all your social media platforms?
On every social media platform that I use, I am B Seepser.
How do you spell that?
Spell that B-S-I-E-P-S-E-R.
And I can be found on X, formerly Twitter, at Daniel J. Glenn, on Instagram, at The Daniel J. Glenn, on Facebook, at Analytical Mastermind, website, danieljglenn.com. And I think that's it. There we go. That's all you got to do. Simple, Denon, simple.
Very simple. What's even simpler, Dan, is if you're listening to us on your favorite podcast channel, it is simple to rate, review, and subscribe.
And also, very simple, on YouTube, hit the like button, subscribe, and ring that bell so you never miss an episode and you help us out to reach more people.
And I will tell you, there's one other thing that's simple, and that's stopping world annihilation and world domination by those who would take the information we've given you in this episode and weaponize it. Remember, when you're given the choice in your life, you always want to be a superhero, never a supervillain. So until next time, thank you for listening. Fascinating Gadgets, Gizmos, and Gear-Based Technologies is a Glencoe production and is produced by me, Daniel J. Glenn. The Fascinating Gadgets, Gizmos, and Gear-Based Technologies introduction was produced by Daniel J. Glenn and Paul Springers, with music and sound design written and performed by Paul Springers. Now, of course, if you're listening to this episode and you've gotten this far, you're going to want to subscribe. Well, how do you do that? We're on all the major podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Spotify. But if you're not already subscribed to those platforms, I made it easy for you. Go to our website, fgbt.com. You'll find links to those subscribe buttons and also links to our social media, both for the show and for our individual experts, the members of the Brain Trust. That's all right there. fgbt.com. And before you leave, don't forget to check out our other episodes. You can find the link at the top of the page for everything we've got, and you'll notice that we've got both a YouTube version and an audio-only version. Depending on what you like, we got it for you. And if you do like those videos, you can go ahead and subscribe to those as well. We're on youtube.com/Daniel J. Glenn. And once again, if you like this show, you're going to like everything that I do. Go to danieljglenn.com to find out more. Thank you for listening.